Hello, podcast listeners. We know podcasts are a great way to catch up on a program that you may have missed on KSJE, and it's provided as a free service of this radio station. But you know, KSJE is now listener-supported, and so while you enjoy this podcast, we hope that you'll also take some time to join KSJE. Become a member today. It's quite easy to do. Just go to our website at ksje.com/support and pick the level of support that best matches your budget. Thanks again for listening. Here's your podcast. Well, let me turn to my guest who is here with me this morning, Dr. Preston Harrington, joining me, as I mentioned, via Zoom from San Juan Health Partners Pediatrics. Dr. Harrington, good morning. It's great to see you. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Thanks for having me, Scott.
You bet. Great to have you here. And so as we were talking, you know, here we are, 2020. It's just this odd year. And so I think we should start with the elephant in the room, and that is COVID-19. A lot of folks are concerned about that with kids. We're hearing lots of information about how COVID affects children and adults maybe a little bit differently. Give us the latest information that you're hearing. And of course, we're learning more about this, it seems, daily almost.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, is that what we know today is might not be exactly what we say a month from now. But so far with kids, the news is really good. Unlike other viruses, the younger you are, the less likely you are to either get it or spread it. And if you do get it, the less likely you are to be sick enough to be in the hospital. And so seriously ill children are very rare with this, and deaths are even rarer. Kind of the other end of the age spectrum is the opposite, of course. Our neighbors who are over 80 are higher risk. And so, but that's why the Academy of Pediatrics is in favor of, in general, reopening schools, getting kids back together, particularly the younger they are. I would say teenagers are maybe in a gray zone. And of course, you would still try to do as much as you could, the social distancing and wearing masks and things like that.
Got you. And but of course, then you have teachers there too. And so we know some teachers maybe aren't as young as they used to be. And so they are in that maybe higher risk category, right? Being around all these young kids who maybe aren't in as high a risk.
Yeah, that's true. And it's we'll have to see how that goes. I think there is some information coming out of Europe with different countries opening up. And it seems like it sort of depends on how much COVID is everywhere in the society as far as how successful you open up a school. So if you open up schools and COVID is sort of raging throughout society in general, you're going to be in more risk than if it's more under control. But yeah, if I was a teacher, I would stay out of the teacher's lounge. I think you're more likely to be catching some other adults than you are from the youngsters.
That's a good point. That's a very good point. And then let me ask you a bit about maybe as we talk about sports too, then, as we've heard in New Mexico, of course, some fall sports have been postponed to the spring. There's other sports that will be getting underway. But again, as you mentioned, as children maybe get older and so maybe get into more of the high school age, COVID maybe becomes more of a potential risk.
I think so, especially if you're talking about team sports where just by definition, people are in close contact. So whereas the golf team is probably low risk, I would think, you know, wrestlers and football players and people that are just going to be in close contact probably would be higher risk. So that's a judgment call as far as when that is safe enough. You know, you the safety may never be zero, but you kind of have to weigh the risks and benefits. And I think right now, again, I think the governor's plan was just to put that off until January and then reassess.
Sure. Well, and I think that's what a lot of folks are maybe hoping for. And of course, everyone, I think, is actively and anxiously hoping for a vaccine that could maybe be some pretty good treatment, or at least for COVID and stop the spread. And I guess that's what everyone is probably pinning their hopes on, right, is that the labs are going to come up with something soon.
Yeah, I think that's the hope. And of course, you know, you can Google and probably get an up-to-date list, but there are several vaccines that are in currently in phase three trials, I think, which is what you need to do. That's the phase that the Russians skipped in order to be able to brag about having the first vaccine. But that's where you get it to a few thousand people and make sure nothing weird happens. You know, there's no guarantee that we'll have a vaccine that is safe and effective, but there's a lot of hope that we will.
Right. And but this, I think, and from all the medical folks that I speak to, this has been the speed at which this has been developed is unprecedented, right? I mean, this is really, folks are really working quickly to try to get this to the public.
Absolutely. And there are some steps that normally take a long time that have been shortcutted. So, for example, normally you wait until you complete phase three and then you ramp up with your factory, and then it's several more weeks before you can mass produce it. But currently, all of the vaccines, we're also ramping up as though they will work. And so that if one happens to be safe and effective, it will be ready to be produced. That means investing in the possibility that some of them we ramp up for, we invest in, and they don't work. But that's, I think it's a good decision because time is important. We don't need another 6 months delay while we're just designing the factories that will ramp this up.
Right. And that brings me to my next line of questions for you, Dr. Harrington, which is vaccines in general. I know when you talk to your parents and their kids, you're a big proponent of vaccines, of course. We know that it keeps kids healthy, and there are certain times during a child's life they need vaccines and things like that. So, again, what do you hear from parents who are coming in to talk about vaccines with you?
Yeah, I think it's the usual. The one thing that happened in some situations with COVID is people were so nervous to come to the doctor that there have been a few people that have gotten a little behind on their shots. I think that's a minority. I think the way the doctor's offices are set up now to minimize time in a waiting room and minimize exposure to other people, I would say people are, for the most part, staying caught up on their vaccines. It will be interesting this year with the flu. You know, normally we're always a proponent of the flu vaccine, particularly now when you have a situation where if you come down with flu-like illness and you wonder, is it the flu or is it COVID? The more people that are vaccinated against the flu, the less complicated it could be having possibly a double outbreak at the same time.
Right. Is that something that you're kind of concerned about, again, in your practice? I mean, with kids aren't, again, when we talk about flu, kids aren't really the most apt to catch flu as opposed to older people, right?
Right. Although the interesting thing with flu that's a little different than COVID is that kids are great petri dishes for the flu. One of the things that protects the grandparents from the flu traditionally was when we began to give flu vaccines to kids in schools. Before that, kids would come to school and some of them were vaccinated, but many of them were not. And they would, you know, you rub shoulders with a few hundred kids every day, and then you go home and visit grandma and bring the flu that may not make you that sick back to grandma, who does get more sick. So COVID's a little different, where it doesn't seem that kids are particularly good petri dishes for COVID. But that's always been a reason to get the flu vaccine, besides your individual self, is the people that you're around that you may pass on the flu to. And in that case, the kids under a year are also, particularly under 6 months, babies can't get the flu vaccine, so they depend on their family members to form sort of a ring of vaccination around them.
I see. And are you expecting, or have you heard anything about the flu vaccines coming out maybe earlier than usual, or being made available earlier than usual to the public to start getting vaccinated against the flu this year?
You know, what I heard last week's update from the governor's office, I think it's Dr. Scrazy, maybe is his name.
Dr. Scrace. Mm-hmm.
Scrace, that's it. Yeah. He talked like there might be some flu vaccine even available this month and certainly by September. That's good news. Some years there's a bit of a delay and we don't have it till October. So it sounds like it'll be September, if not earlier.
Got it. Very good. Well, and I'll put in a little programming plug that actually Dr. Scrace is planning to join us tomorrow here on KSJE on our COVID-19 program at 9 a.m., everyone, for an update. So I will ask him that very question. So there you go. One other thing I wanted to ask you, too, about Dr. Harrington was on whooping cough. That we've seen outbreaks of that, I know, even here locally, right? We've had a lot of cases, but things seem to be helpful because of a vaccine that maybe parents are getting, moms are getting.
Right. Yeah. The whooping cough's an interesting story. Of course, it used to be our parents' generation. There was no vaccine, and so they all got it, and some people got it pretty bad. Then the original vaccine that people my age got was the whole cell vaccine, and it worked well, but it had a high side effect rate of redness and swelling and other things. So then maybe 10 or 15 years ago, I had to lose track, they came up with a more purified one called the acellular pertussis. Everybody was excited about that because of fewer side effects. But the downside is it didn't seem to last as well as either natural immunity or the old vaccine. So pertussis has never really gone away. And the people in society who are most vulnerable to pertussis, it turns out, are the very young. It takes about two vaccines before you're immune. So babies get a 2-month dose and a 4-month dose, but it's not until 6 months that they seem to have improving immunity where they can fight it off. Babies under 6 months who get pertussis often will end up in the hospital and sometimes on ventilators. So the strategy was developed a while back to vaccinate those around them. And that worked somewhat. And then the most recent update was to focus on the mom, that it's not necessarily everybody in the home, but the mom. And so the new recommendation is every time you're pregnant, you get a tetanus / pertussis booster, even if it's once a year. And that seems to be working. So lately, the rate of pertussis in those very young babies has dropped by about half. The rest of us, if we get pertussis, we have a nagging cough for a few months, but a baby gets pertussis is higher risk to be in the hospital and have complications.
Right.
That's good news.
That is good news. And like I said, I think I remember some outbreaks here locally. Am I mistaken about that, or is my memory somewhat correct?
No, there's always a few cases every winter, and so sometimes that will be more like a few dozen cases every winter.
I see.
And I always wonder how many people actually have it and don't even realize it. They just think, oh, it's my allergies or something, and they have kind of a nagging cough. But, of the diseases we vaccinate against, I would say it's one of the more common ones that we still see. The vaccine is not super effective at totally eradicating it. The goal is that if you do get it, you won't have it that bad, and it protects the vulnerable people in society.
Got it. Thank you. My guest this morning, Dr. Preston Harrington, is joining me. He is with San Juan Health Partners Pediatrics. We're talking about children's health and some of the things that he is sharing with us this morning, some of the latest research he's been reading up on. And one of the things you and I were talking about before we came on the air this morning, Dr. Harrington, was some children suffering from leg pain. And it was kind of a mystery, I guess, to doctors at first, but it's come off to be caused by something that's been around for a very long time. Can you talk a little bit about that with me?
Yeah, it was just an interesting report I ran across a few months ago where kids with leg pains or who wouldn't walk, people couldn't figure out they didn't have a fracture. And so they end up, sometimes these mystery cases end up finding their way to a rheumatologist who knows about rare diseases such as arthritis and lupus and things like that. And one clue is that this was maybe a 10 patients in this group, but most of them were autistic. And somebody figured out to check for scurvy. Scurvy is of historical interest. You remember when sailors used to be out at sea for months and not have any vitamin C, they would get scurvy. It's really not something we see much of now, but it's something to think about if you have somebody with leg pains who has a restrictive diet. So some kids with autism just will refuse to eat anything but Cheetos and macaroni, let's say. And so it's one of the reasons we recommend a multivitamin for every kid with autism, but it's also something to think about if somebody has these mysterious leg pains. Is once you've excluded the fracture and the more common things is, well, maybe we'll check the vitamin C level. Maybe he's got very low vitamin C. And of course, once you find that, it's very easy to fix. You can give someone vitamin C and right away they're simply better. That was just sort of an interesting case report, I think.
Yeah, very much so. And again, like you said, this is something that's been around for years and years and years. We don't hear about it much anymore with modern medicine, but it's certainly a lack of vitamin C is certainly easier to fix than maybe a more serious problem with leg pain and things like that, whether it's arthritis or muscle problems or lupus or all the other things that you mentioned. So
right.
I can see why parents would maybe breathe a sigh of relief, but this is something to maybe consider. The other thing, too, is on SIDS, which, of course, affects infants, and there's evolving thoughts about that, correct?
Right. We've known probably for 20 years now that sleep position is one of the risk factors. And so that's why we tell all parents to always lay their baby down on their back to sleep. Now, sometimes a baby will turn himself or herself over, and that's okay. But particularly very young, in the first couple months, babies who are not on their back are at higher risk. The other thing they talk about is really having nothing in the crib except the baby and the baby's blanket. And so this report was talking about how crib bumpers are still very popular. People think that they are safe, that somehow they keep the baby from banging his head on the bars of the crib, I suppose. But it turns out that there have been cases of SIDS associated with the crib bumpers. Baby getting kind of nestled up into the corner and that contributing to the SIDS. Other things we know, like smoking, secondhand smoke, and co-sleeping. So babies that are very young that are sleeping in the bed with parents, those are all risk factors for SIDS. We still don't know really what causes SIDS. All we know is that certain factors seem to be associated.
Interesting. And of course, that's just got to be so scary for a new parent, right, to make sure you're doing the right thing. And so, again, the recommendation is just a baby, blanket, crib, that's it.
Right. Once they're older, you can start to have all the cute things and the stuffed animals and all of that. But in the first few months, should just be the baby and the covering.
Got it. Very good. And Dr. Herrington, talk to me a little bit about how you know, the patients that you are seeing. You mentioned earlier that maybe a lot of folks at the beginning of the lockdown and the pandemic, folks were maybe not coming to see their doctor and were understandably concerned. And medical offices and hospitals now, of course, have instituted protocols to keep everyone safe and to handle patient volumes and things along that line. Is that what's happening, of course, at your office too?
Yes, absolutely. And we're with San Juan Health Partners, we're under the umbrella of San Juan Regional Medical Center, which has had an outstanding approach to the COVID. You know, they, as you know from your other guests, they've been out in front of this, and so they have given us oversight and generally have erred on the side of being cautious. When in doubt, we're going to do the cautious thing. So as we've opened up, we've had protocols in place so that no longer will you walk into the doctor's office and there'll be 15 people in the waiting room and half of them are coughing and sneezing. And I think for the most part, all the doctors in the community are on the same page with that. So there's alternative ways where people are waiting in their cars. Just like you and I are meeting over Zoom, we have similar software where many patient visits can actually happen from home, where the patient doesn't even need to come to the doctor's office. So so the changes are in place. I would say that the chance of catching COVID at the doctor's office is significantly less than catching it at a large retail store.
Got it. Good to know. Very good. And of course, when it comes to kids, and we talked about sports earlier, but sports physicals is something that happens usually this time of year. Is that still happening or not so much with things being postponed?
I would say it's less. I do have some patients, you know, some people are disorganized and they don't realize until you need a physical in 2 days and it becomes an emergency.
Right.
And so since those sports have been many of those sports put off till January, we're not seeing the rush. Although I would say the more on top of it families, or the families who just say, well, we like to get a sports physical every August. And so I would say I'm seeing maybe two a day as opposed to, you know, three or four times that many normally in August. And I figured the time will come once they get the green light, then suddenly we'll have a rush in December. Who knows?
Right. Well, and these sports physicals can be useful, right? Because sometimes we hear about these young, seemingly very healthy young people, these student athletes that maybe have some other type of hidden problem, and a sports physical or other tests can maybe uncover some of this stuff before they go out on the field and exert themselves. And we hear these stories all the time, it seems.
Right. That's always the nightmare situation, is a previously healthy teenager who is, let's say, playing basketball and just collapses with a heart rhythm problem and basically needs to be resuscitated. And so the hope with the sports physical is to pick up on kids that are at risk for that and get them further evaluation. That's kind of a combination of asking about family history as well as symptoms. So somebody who's having chest pain on a regular basis, or is fainting or feeling lightheaded on a regular basis, or somebody with the family history of a cousin or an uncle who was young and had an unexplained sudden death. Those would be the things we're looking for, as well as the physical exam. There are things you can hear with the heart. So oftentimes we'll use the visit. So those are all rare, and we're glad they're rare. We also can pick up on other things, such as more mental health issues. Some teenagers are having some anxiety or depression, as well as the obesity situation, where you might pick up on young people who need to be checked, make sure they're not starting down the path towards diabetes. So we take advantage of the fact that the schools require a sports physical, and then we have our own agenda where we make sure that we sort of cover all the other bases.
Right. You mentioned mental health, which I think is a great thing to follow up on, in that you and I have talked previously, I think, about kids and spending a lot of time on their screens, and of course, kids in video games and kids in computers and social media and things along that line. And now school is on a screen. And so does that concern you, maybe, that they're getting even additional screen time these days than maybe what is recommended or what we would like in a perfect world?
Yeah, I think it's not the perfect situation. If somebody just spends all day staring at a computer screen, I'd much rather that kids be at school where they can interact with their peers and their teachers. I understand there are trade-offs, and so you want to make sure that's safe before you do that. And yeah, there was another article I ran across a few months ago that looked at the association between screen time, increased screen time, and depression in adolescents. It's a good example of, in my mind, being careful not to equate correlation with causation. So all we can say is there's a correlation, that kids who spend a lot of time on let's say, social media and video games and that sort of thing will have a higher risk for depression. But it's hard to say that it's causing that. It may well be that something else is making them depressed, and then they end up having more screen time secondary to the depression. But it is a correlation. Not all screen time is exactly the same. I would not be worried about 6 hours a day in actual class as much as I would be worried about 6 hours a day on social media.
Understood. Very, very true. And that leads me, I think, to maybe a final line of questions too. We have just a couple of minutes remaining this morning, and I know you do spend some time on social media, as do I, and I may be asking for a bit of advice from you, because we see a lot of things on social media that are maybe partly true, half true, not really true, especially when it comes to maybe the COVID-19. And I don't want to get political necessarily, but do you have any good pieces of advice for folks as we learn more? As we talked about at the very beginning of this program, we are learning more daily about the coronavirus and COVID-19 and getting new recommendations from health professionals and state and federal leaders. Where should we go for good information? Are there any rules of thumb for how to make decisions for our own lives, our own families?
Yeah, I'm glad that's a big topic. And I do get irritated. I think all of us need to watch out for just finding ourselves an echo chamber or a bubble where all of our sources of information have been pre-selected to reinforce what we already think. Somehow or other, wearing a mask has become a political issue, which is a little bit mind-boggling. Sometimes I get sucked into conversations where I'm trying to educate people, and then I realize they're really not interested in my opinion. They've already made up their mind based on their echo chamber and the sources of information that they have locked themselves into. So in general, I recommend we have a skepticism, and especially when we hear something that reinforces something we already think. So if we already have an opinion about whatever, and then we see a news report that confirms that, that should raise a flag to say, well, let me double check that and see if that's corroborated by another source. I there are many websites. I tend to trust the government, so I think if you go to cdc.gov or the New Mexico Health Department website, I don't believe there's a big conspiracy out there. I guess if you already believe those conspiracies, it's difficult to find your way out that mindset. But another website that a friend pointed me to that I think is interesting and fun to look at is the worldometer.info. I don't know if you've ever looked at that, but even before COVID, apparently they count the world population. And so anything you're interested in knowing, like, well, pick a country or pick an area, how many cases of COVID, how many new cases, how many deaths, And as far as I can tell, they're not really putting a spin on it, so they're not they don't have an agenda. They're just publishing data. I think we still have experts. So if you have questions about COVID, most of us have a physician or a nurse practitioner or a physician assistant that we trust. And I think running it by them, people in our position have had years of training, and it gives us a little perspective. And so if you wonder whether the news is just having a political spin, I think, talking to people that are health professionals is a good idea. I think it starts with the mindset, though, of not just eagerly looking for information that confirms what you already know about any issue.
Right. I understand, and I appreciate your answer. And again, when it comes to science and when it comes to something new like this, again, this is the novel coronavirus. We haven't seen it before. There is evolving and understanding of how this thing spreads and how contagious it is, and evolving information about how to keep it from spreading. Isn't that why maybe some of the messaging has been a bit changing from month to month over the past 6 months?
Exactly. And some people, I think, maybe forget that that's how science works. So they'll say, well, wait a minute, 6 months ago they were telling us this, and now they're telling us that. We can't trust anything they say. And, the way science works is it's self-correcting. So I think closing the schools initially was the smart move, because many viruses will spread among kids and make kids severely ill. If we could have seen the future, we would know that, schools aren't really a big deal. So you don't know everything, and it's one of the reasons I give our leaders a little bit of grace, from the presidency down through the governors. They're having to make decisions based on incomplete information, and then hopefully reassessing once you have more information. But, right, if we have a conversation a year from now, we may look back and say, there's something that we thought was true that turned out to be not true about coronavirus.
Right, and we can point to several sources to back that up. So there you go. Well, Dr. Harrington, it's been a great conversation this morning. I appreciate your time and being with me again. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks for having me, Scott.
Always a pleasure. Thank you. That's Dr. Preston Harrington from San Juan Health Partners Pediatrics, my guest here on KSJE. Back with more in just a moment, everyone. The time right now is 8:40. Did you enjoy that podcast? We hope that you did. And if you did, share it with your friends. And if you really want to keep podcasts like this coming, please support KSJE. You can do it easily online at ksje.com.